seen as the only feasible option to control invasive species, not only in agricultural settings, but also in natural areas. This faces with a challenge since currently there is no generalized risk assessment procedures, at least in the United States. The study that I'm presenting to you today is set in Hawaii, and Hawaii is the most isolated island chain on Earth and has a higher proportion of invasive species than any other place of similar size, has a very high rate of endemism, and there has been more than 700 introductions made in the past 100 years. It has also been the center of controversy regarding non-target impacts of biological control. This started with the publication of Francis Howard in the 1980s, and in this publication he claimed extinctions of native Lepidoptera species due to attacks by purposely introduced species. After this, more quantitative studies started on the islands, such as the one by Henneman and Mehmod in a remote site on the island of Kauai, and they found that most of the parasitoid species associated with larvae of native Lepidoptera species were actually purposely introduced. Some other studies, such as the one by Johnson et al. On purposely introduced parasitoids to control the green stingbat Nessara viridula, they found that impacts of these purposely introduced species on native species were actually minimal when compared to effects caused by accidental introductions. So even when we can detect non-target parasitism, it might not mean that there is an impact at the population level. The non-target species subject of this study is Judea stellata, order Lepidoptera, family Crambidae. The host plants are the also endemic Pipteros spp in the family Urticacea. And in laboratory studies, we determined that this moth undergoes 6 larval stages. The parasitoids associated with this endemic moth are 7, 3 in the category adventive or accidental introduced, 2 in the category unknown, unknown origin, and 2 purposely introduced parasitoids. Cotitia marginiventris and Meteorus lafignae were introduced to control sugarcane pests. The objective of this study is to determine the relative contribution of parasitoids on the population dynamics of Judea stellata by constructing partial life tables. The studies were carried on 3 islands, in the island of Kauai at the Koke State Park, on Oahu at 3 sites, and on the island of Hawaii or Big Island on 2 sites. These sites vary especially in elevation and level of disturbance. So what did we need for these studies? We had to establish colonies of the non-target moth, and since we conducted the studies on 3 different islands, we had to keep 3 different colonies, each one starting from larvae field collected from the respective island. We also raised plants from seeds, each from the respective island, and we used the 6 different instars of the moth. So what did we do in the field and in the lab? First, we have to transport the plants to the field. And once there, we deploy sentinel larvae on sentinel plants at a density of 4 larvae per plant. We deployed all different instars at the same time, and keeping different instars on different plants. We had 2 treatments, open and exclusion treatments. Open and exclusion, and in the open treatment, the larvae were exposed to parasitism and predation, whereas in the exclusion treatment, we put a fine mesh over the plants to exclude any predators or parasitoids. The larvae were left in the field for 3 full days, and after this time, we came back and we retrieved the larvae. We brought them back to the lab for rearing, and then emerging parasitoids were identified, first pin and then identified. With this data, we constructed partial life tables using the method described by Morris and Miller. We also calculated marginal attack rates and the associated K values, or killing powers, which allow comparison of mortality factors among sites. And now I will show you some results. Now, this slide shows the K values by larval stage across sites in the open and exclusion treatment. The X-axis shows the different larval stages, The y-axis shows the k-values, and the different color bars represent the different mortality factors. Like, for example, the line in beige represents disappearance. The line in turquoise represents death due to unknown reasons. And then the different colors, the other colors represent the different parasitoids reared from the exposed larvae, such as the color blue and red represent the purposely introduced species. So bear in mind that the axis is different for the two different graphs. And we can see here that in the open treatment, the figure on the top, the major mortality factor was disappearance, whereas in the exclusion treatment, the major mortality factor was death due to unknown reason. There was, in the open treatment, we have a higher rate of disappearance that was significantly higher compared to the exclusion treatment. Now, I have to say here that in the exclusion treatment, we have a very high recovery rate that was 92%, so that means a high surge efficiency. Which suggests that the main cause of disappearance in the open treatment might have been predation. Also, in this study, we did not dissect larvae that died due to unknown reason, but there was no significant difference between death due to unknown reason between the two treatments. So this suggests that other causes, such as natural mortality or stress, were the cause of this type of mortality rather than parasitism. Now, if we look at parasitism in the open treatment, we see that they contributed the least to total mortality. Adventive parasitoids such as Triclistus, the line in green, and Tratala ferorbitalis in gray, were the ones that had the highest K values due to parasitism. The next, this slide shows the K values by site across all larval stages in the open treatment. In this case, the x-axis shows the different sites with information on elevation and island, and the y-axis shows the K values. Here also the different color lines represent the different mortality factors that I explained before. And so what we can get from this slide is that the main mortality factor across all sites was disappearance, followed by death due to unknown reason. And parasitism caused had the least contribution to total mortality. And the parasitoids Triclistus and Tratala ferorbitalis in green and gray had the highest contribution to mortality in almost all sites. And the purposely introduced species that you cannot really see here were actually recorded in sites like Coque, Kipukaki, and Olaa, that were the ones in higher elevations. So to summarize the findings of this study, there was low impact of parasitoid species in this study system. Adventive parasitoids inflicted greater total mortality compared to introduced species. Disappearance was the major mortality factor in this experiment, because there was a higher disappearance on the open treatment when compared to the exclusion treatment. This suggests that predation might have been the main cause of this disappearance. And parasitism by different species varied across sites, and that this might be because of contrasting ecological factors. So we can conduct this type of study because they help us build case histories to look for patterns and predict outcomes of future introductions. Doing that, we can identify key biological and ecological factors that might be underlying these non-target effects and can be incorporated in order to propose generalized quantitative risk assessment procedures. So biocontrol can continue to be a tool to control invasive species. Finally, I would like to acknowledge all these people and organizations, and if you have any questions, I will be glad to take them now.
I'll be discussing our knowledge, current knowledge of the Arctiid phylogeny, and placing what we know about primarily larval life histories in an evolutionary context. This work is not possible without a network, sort of like the Verizon Wireless Network. I have my network, And all these people significantly contributed to what I'm about to tell you. And I would also like to give photo credits right up front to Bill Connor and Dan Jansen, without whom this would be a terribly under-illustrated talk. So thank you very much for your gorgeous photos. The Arctiad is a, I won't call it mega-diverse, I've been humbled by the Galechioids, but a reasonably beautifully diverse family. If you collect in the Neotropics, they represent up to 11% of the species you could expect to see at the sheet at night. And certainly their eye-popping adults catch our attention. Their caterpillars, likewise, are very beautiful. And all these beautiful colors, of course, are signaling to us the fact that many of them are chemically protected. The pyrrolizidine alkaloid story has been worked out quite well for Udothysa ornatrix, and I won't belabor it here, but just the caterpillars do obtain toxins, the pyrrolizidine alkaloids, while feeding on their hosts, and transfer these compounds to the adult stage. It has been shown by many studies that pyrrolizidine alkaloids are effective against a number of predators, vertebrates and invertebrates. Matter of fact, one of the favorite ways to test whether or not a moth, an Arctiad, is chemically protected is to, let's see if I can do this without popping to the next slide, is to throw the moth into the web of the common garden spider, and if it is protected, the spider will cut it out of the web, hold it off to the side, and drop it. So, phew. But if it's a yummy moth, it'll just go ahead and suck its blood. So, pyrrolizidine alkaloids can also be effective against parasitoids, and perhaps the most interesting story to recently be discovered and tested is how the Gramia incorrupta larvae self-medicate. So just like if you run a fever and you run and grab a Tylenol or whatever to bring your fever down, these guys feed on a wide variety of plants, and if they are parasitized, they preferentially eat PA-containing plants, which improves their survival rate. And the complicated tritrophic interactions will be much more elegantly described by Mike Singer this afternoon in the Liz Bernay Symposium, which is just around the corner from here. So if you'd like to learn more about self-medicating caterpillars, I highly recommend you go hear Mike's talk. And of course, there's been a ton of work done on how pyrrolizidine alkaloids show up in the courtship of the adults. Males will court females in ornatrix. If he has pyrrolizidine alkaloids, he'll hang around. She will allow him to mate. If he's a underperforming PA male, well, too bad, so sad. She'll find another mate. So, but not all Arctiads are tied to pyrrolizidine alkaloids. And as a matter of fact, many larvae are capable of producing their own suite of chemistries without obtaining them from host plants. These can be very irritating compounds that cause swelling or are generally distasteful. These can act in combination with other chemicals, so there's a synergistic effect if they do sequester plant compounds. And there's even one that's named for Arctiacacia by Miriam Rothschild, which is transported in the hemolymph of the larva. Now, and I should also mention that there are a number of compounds in addition to pyrrolizidine alkaloids that show up in Arctiidae. There's a whole lineage that feeds on lichens, and and sequestration of lichen compounds has been demonstrated. Cardiac glycosides, there's switches to milkweeds and other plants that have CGs. And most recently, Dean Bowers has been documenting the use of iridoid glycosides in spilosoma and relatives. So I would say that when it comes to larval chemical defenses, There's quite a bit that we know, and we're still discovering more, which is an exciting place to be. Oh, and so one question we could ask is, how is there any pattern to how these chemistries are being used in the Arctiidae? Are they labile evolutionarily, or are they conserved within large lineages? What exactly is happening in Arctiids? And so, obviously, we need a phylogenetic tree. And what I will be doing now is introducing to you one of these. I never started the timer, Amanda. So we'll have to check the watch.